Good morning again. Myra Sun for Seneca Neal. And this is a Fourth Amendment case, and it's like the house that eventually got searched here. It has many entrances. So I'm going to start with the entrance that began, that's presented by my client's motions. We know that he challenged the adequacy of the search warrant affidavit at this Arctic address, and it's number 3. That's in the front part of the house. The officers who went there that day had a warrant to search number 5 on the other side of the house, another what we view as self-contained residence. We think of this as like a multiplex or a fiveplex. Just because you can search one person's part of that dwelling doesn't mean you can search someone else's. So we agree with the magistrate's finding that the expectation of privacy in number 3 was distinct from number 5. We agree that this was a home. There was an entrance hallway, there was a kitchen, and the officers actually went in past the kitchen to see what they saw. So there are 3 categories of evidence in that warrant affidavit that we attack. First is evidence from the GPS tracker. And that would be the surveillance that they conducted using the GPS tracker that led them to the Arctic address.
They have a warrant for that?
They did get a warrant. I'm going to talk about why that lacked probable cause in our view.
Cops don't attend CLE.
Sorry?
Who said cops don't attend CLE?
Well, on this one they have to, I think. I mean, I think at least they know about what the Supreme Court says. So the second category of evidence is evidence that they got that day when they went to the Arctic address and went wherever it is they went in the front part of the house. They seized him. They seized his cell phone, and they spoke to him without giving him Miranda rights. In our view, that was an arrest. And then finally, there's a smaller category of evidence obtained after he was arrested, conversations with neighbors. So let me start with the GPS. A GPS warrant still has to have probable cause, and it's just like any other Fourth Amendment location that we search. There has to be a reason to believe that tracking someone's whereabouts in that vehicle is going to lead to evidence of contraband, or in this case, I think what they hoped for was the location of contraband, which is to say that would get them to contraband. And so for that, it seems to me there has to be a reasonable basis to believe that the person drives the vehicle and that he drives it for the purpose of storing drugs or transporting drugs. In other words, in our view, the main thing that the officers were able to confirm once they heard from this informant that my client owned this car or had a car like this was that it was registered to him. But they, after they knew that, all they did was go and see a residence where he was there and the car was there. And I understand that probable cause isn't like being certain, but in fact, registration, a car being registered to you and seeing it, you with it once, doesn't mean that there's probable cause to believe that you're going to find contraband from tracking it.
Well, Mr., didn't the informant also say, I've bought drugs from Mr. Neal and he drives that car?
I've bought drugs from Mr. Neal. He drives that car. He didn't connect the two. Mr. Neal's a drug dealer. Right.
Right.
That's
so, it seems to me you may have better probable cause arguments as to some of the other parts of the search, but as to the tracker, I mean, you have an informant saying, that's the guy who I bought drugs for. And they went and they checked, and lo and behold, the car is at his residence and is registered to him.
I understand.
But when, what more should they have done to...
It seems to me that in the world, people have families, and there's a car, and it's your wife's car, and then there's a car, and it's your car. And it just doesn't seem to me that registration alone is enough to link you to the car. I understand that Mr. Strom said that he was a drug dealer. I understand.
They follow the car, and then they encounter the girlfriend.
They followed the car, and they saw conduct that made them believe that there was drug trafficking between him and this young woman. Yes. But that was, I think that was with the tracker. I'm sorry.
He tells them that the drugs came from Neil?
I think that that was after the drug tracker, Your Honor. So the things that they learned from the surveillance.
And did she tell them that Neil lived in this complex?
I think that mainly what she did was let them look at her phone and they saw texts between the two of them. That is the primary evidence I believe they got from the young woman.
Then they got a warrant to search Unit 3?
Unit 5.
Unit 5.
And I don't know what she said, and the affidavit for number 5 is not in this record. It was sealed in the state court. I couldn't get it. I didn't get it.
Get the warrant on,
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
They go in to search the unit number 3, and they see Neil?
They go to search number 3 that they don't have a They go to the address. They don't have a warrant to search that front part of the house where number 3 is, with those two doors, the red door and the white door. And once you go into the red door, you're basically in what we regard as the house, his house. And they didn't have a warrant to search that part of the house. And the magistrate found that that was a self-contained home and that they didn't have a warrant to search it. And that their entry into that space to see him come out of number 3 or them standing right outside after they went in and got the lay of the land was illegal. For some reason, he did not believe that the subsequent seizure of my client was, and the statements and cell phone they got from him should be suppressed. It is, of course, our view that he should. So on the GPS tracker, we believe there isn't probable cause, and I understand that the court disagrees with that. The evidence gotten from their foray into number 3 is the second category of evidence. And this brings up that body recording, which we did lodge, and I think the government lodged. And I just want to remind the court of the chronology briefly. The original suppression motion was filed in August 2015. That's docket number 66. The government now says that this body recording was purportedly produced in September of 2015. And that's their supplemental filings, which we don't actually think show that the body recording itself was produced. There was some disc labeled it, but they didn't show that that's what that disc was. And then in October 2015, there was a reply filed, doesn't mention getting a body recording. The hearing was held in February 2016, and at that point, the officer whose body recording it was didn't testify, and the other one said, I'm not sure there is a body recording, and if there is, I haven't listened to it. And then when the objections to the magistrate's ruling were filed at docket 154 in June of 2016, the counsel said, I looked into getting this body recording and was told, he does use the word informal. I don't know what that means. He doesn't explain it. But he said his understanding is there is no recording. So I just want to be very clear that no matter what the government says, the defense did not have this body recording.
Well, hold on. We don't know that.
We don't know that. Okay. The defense did not believe it had this body recording for use at the February 2016 hearing. And I think that that's, well, I can't imagine why that wouldn't be the case if he said what he said in docket number 154. And the government doesn't seem to challenge the materiality of that recording to the circumstances of the seizure and the evidence that was taken then, because a lot of it is recorded, the statements and then the cell phone.
Okay. Ask you one thing. We're kind of talking in these vague verbs about whether defense counsel thought or might not have thought that he had a recording. I thought there was a FedEx shipment of evidence and
right.
That the recording was in that FedEx shipment.
That's what the government is saying. There's a.
Is there any
it's almost like a.
Contrary to that?
Not to the FedEx, Your Honor. There is a sort of a receipt that I understand defense counsel signed to say, yes, I got this package and it's correct. I mean, in theory, what you're supposed to do is look at it, look at what you got and go, oh, wait a minute, this says that's in there. It's not in here. All we have here is that it wasn't signed. I don't think the government lodged a signed sort of acknowledgement of receipt from defense counsel as to that delivery. And I'm sure Mr. Scrocky will correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure the government will correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe he acknowledged receipt of that.
So you're saying counsel didn't get it or didn't acknowledge receipt?
He didn't acknowledge receipt, which, and there's a place for him to sign if he does, so that means what that means. And we know that at trial, on day two, this same investigator's testifying earlier in the day, and the government says, and they confirm that there's a recording, and that's at excerpt of record 95 and 96. Yes, there's a recording, and the government says, we may come back to that later if we can put that together, which I would argue suggests that it's sort of, he just realized he had it too. And at the end of that trial day, he puts that witness, investigator Colt, back on the stand, excerpt 159, and that's when they play these statements. And then the next day is when the defense brings in the rest of it. So this goes to the government's claim that there is a waiver. And before I go on, I just want to say we have asked the court to remand, and I would ask the court to consider remanding for some sort of hearing about the production of this recording, because I think that what happened here is that Colt said many things when he testified at the suppression hearing that aren't borne out by that recording. And it seems to me the magistrate ought to know that what he says happened isn't borne out by that recording. And I've included some authority that talks about how a court can consider what's adduced at trial in ruling on a suppression motion, and they can even do that on appeal. And I just have to correct that the footnote to United States versus Thomas, in which I talk about various cases are collected, that's footnote 6, not footnote 2. And that's at page 26 of my brief, and I'm sorry about that.
Not a problem.
Okay, so my client didn't waive, in part. There are two kinds of waiver the government says happened here. One is that he waived his entire challenge to the search warrant that he made pretrial. It does seem to me that this is a fairly conventional case. Once you make a motion to suppress evidence, it's not as though you have to object to its admission again at trial. And remember, it was the government that initially brought in the body recording at trial. They brought it in at the end of day two. My client's lawyer didn't bring it in. What the government did was play part of that recording, and then the defense asked to play the rest of it. And so I don't think he waived by bringing in something that the government had already brought in when it was the subject of a suppression motion that he'd already made. The other claim that the government says waived was waiver of the claims of unlawful arrest and questioning and the phone search that we make relying on United States versus Nora in our brief. And this was a suppression motion, it seems to me, that was brought. It basically sought suppression of all evidence based on the unlawful entry into number 3. And he believed that, it seems to me, that that was, in fact, an unlawful entry in terms of the seizure of the statements in the phone. At his objections to the adverse findings from the magistrate, which are at clerk's record 154, pages 4 and 5, he talks about how he believes the reasoning for admitting it seems flawed to the extent that the evidence obtained subsequent to Mr. Neal's arrest was a direct result and fruit of the officer's unlawful entry into the apartment. That's a quote from that part of his objection. So we don't think he waived that claim either. And next, if it is believed that he...
Remaining time?
Yes, I guess I better. Thank you, Your Honor. Sorry.
Good morning, Your Honor. Stephen Scrocky with the U.S. Attorney's Office for the United States. I noticed this morning the calendar mentioned Stephen Cooper was doing the argument this morning. Mr. Cooper resigned 2 weeks ago.
We have you substituted.
Excellent.
Correctly. Thank you.
And good morning.
Mr. Scrocky?
Scrocky, Your Honor, yes.
Scrocky.
any way you see fit to pronounce this.
My iPad says my pleasure. I'm trying to get to the brief, but
I'm going to go right to the end on this case. Unless you have some questions about the GPS tracker, I'm happy to answer those. But the issue here is, does the court really feel, based on this record and the facts that the defense has articulated, is there a reason to invoke the exclusionary rule to any aspect of the claims that they're making here this morning? With respect to the issue of the arrest and the troopers going into the common area of the apartment, it's harmless error. All of the complaints that they're making here this morning, even if they were provided to the court at trial, even if they were suppressed, none of it would have made any difference, because at the end of the day, the trial evidence in this case was absolutely overwhelming. We had two cooperating defendants testifying during this trial. We had independent source evidence from the phone records, which is complained about, that his phone was seized. But we had information from Ms. Solomon and text to Mr. Neal the day of the that he provided her with heroin. We have records from phone companies that were introduced at the trial showing numerous thousands of phone calls between Mr. Neal, Mr. Washington, and Mr. Strum, both who testified during the trial. Mr. Strum testified as to the numbers of sales he had done with Mr. Neal over time. Mr. Washington did the same thing. We have independent evidence establishing where Mr. Neal lived in apartment number 3. The landlord was interviewed. The tenant from number 2 in the apartment was interviewed. They both described Mr. Neal physically. Both described him as somebody who would come and go infrequently. And all that information corroborated, most importantly in this case, the physical surveillance conducted by the troopers outside of what the tracker provided them in information. If the court looks at the record here with the search warrants and the testimony, that tracker was only used 3 times. The first 2 times, Mr. Neal went to his residence on Arctic. After that, 5, 6, 7 times, he did the park a block away from the residence, which was physically surveilled by law enforcement officers, as well as a plane up above on November 12th. So the tracker argument really doesn't make much sense here, because it really didn't carry the day and carry any weight with respect to the law enforcement officer's physical surveillance, because really the tracker just tells you where a vehicle goes, doesn't tell you who's driving it, doesn't tell them where it ultimately ended up. And frankly, at the end of the day, the physical surveillance provided the officers in the affidavit more important information in the search warrant than the tracker information did, because it established Mr. Neal was doing things to avoid conduct by law enforcement. So with respect to all of the complaints here, if the court looks at it in terms of, do we need to reverse this case for sentencing or for a retrial or for a hearing, it doesn't make any difference. With respect to count 7, even if the court suppresses the evidence from the search of the apartment and the pound of heroin, which had Mr. Neal's fingerprints on it, that doesn't matter either, because it's not going to change the sentence at the end of the day. That's only 0.5 kilo, and he was sentenced to 6 or 7 kilos, and it wouldn't matter even if that was suppressed. And that's our contention throughout the whole brief. So unless you have any further questions, I'll reserve my time for my colleague.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Dodds, could you please put a minute back on the clock to give her some extra time for rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would disagree with the government's reading of the record that what the government obtained about my client was based on physical surveillance. It began with there's some testimony in which the officer talks about them getting. We saw a pattern with what the tracker was showing us, and it showed us that he went to a lot of different locations, so you have to narrow those down. What we found is that he was going over to 5402 Arctic on November 6th and 7th. To me, that testimony means that they discovered Arctic from the tracker. So it was not independent. I disagree that the error is harmless. First of all, if you vacate count 7, which we think should happen because the evidence was suppressed, if we vacate count 7, then the sentencing package is unbundled. And what we have is that was actually the only seizure of drugs in this case. The rest of the amount, the rest of the quantity was an extrapolation from the testimony of others. And I just want to quickly note that the seizure of the phone from my client's person really matters, because we have many texts, and I understand that, But to take the phone from his person means he's the one using it and not someone else. And that is always a possibility with a mobile phone.
Thank you.
We'll submit it.
Thank you. United States versus Neal is submitted. I thank both of you for your argument.